This is At the Races with Steve Beck.
From the Treasure Island in Las Vegas, the National Horse Players Championship, the 2019 edition, the 20th. They really should have started this contest on the year so that each year would correspond, so that 2020 would have been the 20th year, 19 would have been the 19th year. Good morning, everybody, and kind of laughing because Roger Satina, who is much the same way that Darren Rogers kicks off the Derby coverage, the invocation, as we call it. Roger has become the official kickoffer to let me plug Roger in here, the official first voice you hear of there's Keith Shamblin. He's ready to preside over day one of the NHC, and let me make sure that Roger is with voice. Roger,
I'm here.
Look at you. The skyscraper himself, ready for another run at the NHC.
10 years.
10 straight?
This is the 10th one, yeah.
Yeah, and most notably, though, about as close a set of harrowing finishes as really any player on the contest scene.
Yeah, hopefully we'll get it done this year.
Second twice. I don't think there's anybody else that can make that claim.
No, I don't think so.
There's been a lot of top 10, you know, multiple top 10 finishes, but not running second. I'm going to forget. Who'd you run second behind?
Well, I finished between Duke and Paul, and then behind Jim Bennis in 13.
Okay. Wasn't here for 13. Started coming. This is our fifth. I was speculating. I think the fifth year we've broadcast from Vegas for the NHC, and you know the contest continues to kind of morph and evolve and grow as well. And this year there'll be a second ballroom downstairs. They've done a big multi-million dollar renovation, not of the rooms, but but of the of the convention facility. Yeah, the front doors could use a polishing. The ballrooms, though, downstairs, they on the casino level and out toward the pool. It's the first time, not that anybody's going in that pool unless you're a member of the Polar Bear Club.
Yeah, definitely. It's freezing here.
It's colder. I got off the plane yesterday. It's colder here than it was when I left Albany.
New York was 60, over 60 on Tuesday when I left and came here. I was like, wow.
Last year was my first experience where I said, you know what, you better not leave the coat at home and bring a little bit. They had snow apparently the other morning, and all the mountains are snow-capped.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah, crazy.
You know, the thing is, what's interesting when it comes to the NHC and the time spent here, there's really not a lot of time out and about. There aren't people taking tours of Lake Mead, and you're here. You actually spend more time probably in the hotel room than you do any other time you travel anywhere, because so many races and so many cards to have to absorb. How do you approach it, Roger? Because 8 different tracks for the 2 days leading in, and you know the mandatories. We got the Friday mandatories released earlier this morning, actually.
Oh, I didn't even see that.
I got it for you here, actually. I'm right on top of it. In fact, Roger, yeah, there we go. And I've even got the PPs for printed out already for Friday. But how do you approach it, Roger, to be on top of all of those races that you have to basically be familiar with all 8 cards in case there's a betting opportunity?
So I usually come Tuesday night, and then I'll spend Wednesday looking at Friday's card. Thoroughgraph does a great job getting the numbers out.
Yep.
Earlier than typical, so that you get a chance to look at them. So So yesterday I spent the day doing Friday's races, and today I'll spend the day doing Sunday's races. And then tomorrow morning early, I'll go and recap Friday and just put the finishing touches on it. And then it's just really a question of making decisions after that. You know, you pick the races out you like, and you just sit and you wait for them. And that's basically what I do. And I just try to identify the contenders in the field and then hopefully go the right way when the time comes.
Where do you gravitate when it comes to the electives, to the, you know, the races, the non-mandatories that you're going to pick? And you know, I want to parse that out into both categories, what your mandatory approach is, but what kind of electives do you typically chase?
So I usually go for the biggest fields. So these days, those are grass races, mostly. So when I looked at Friday's cards, that's where you gravitate to. It seems like the dirt racing, other than Oaklawn, has gone like by the wayside in this country. Like the dirt fields are just, I mean, especially Gulfstream's dirt races, like they're hideous. They really are. They're bad. So you just, you know, I try to look at every race at every track, which I did yesterday. For Friday, I went through Golden Gate and everything, but you know, when there's a 5-horse field, then it's really not that much to look at, so you don't spend as much time on it. But a winner can come from anywhere.
Let's look at the grass races for a second and the larger fields. Do you care if the turf sprint or route? Any particular maiden levels, allowance levels, if appropriate? And of course, on Saturday we'll get stakes opportunities. What does it matter to you at all, or is it strictly pure handicapping?
It's pure handicapping. Actually, the cheaper races I like better. Like the maiden claimers, I like on the grass especially. Claiming races, allowance is fine. Stakes races, okay. I'm not like waiting to bet a stake race though. To me, I like the cheaper horses.
You and Brad Free. Brad Free gave me a lot of confidence. That was one area that used to throw me to, and I used to grouse when there would be a sequence, a pick four, let's say, that it ended with a, you know, a 16 claimer or a 10 non-2, and I would just, to me, the horses a lot of times all look the same, and Brad Free talked me out of that at some point and said, you know, particularly, maybe not for the maidens so much, low levels, but when it came to straight claimers at the low level, he said, very formful starter allowances have always been a problem for me, because having to analyze everybody's condition, because there's a lot of insight to be gleaned there.
There is a lot, but they all look the same. That means there's 5 or 6 of them can win, and one of them is going to be 15-1.
And you like that. You would prefer, for contest purposes, how about when you're playing for cash on a regular weekend?
Yeah.
It doesn't
matter. Absolutely. Absolutely. Like earlier this year is a perfect example. I think it was Santa Anita Derby Day. So Gulfstream had a so-so card. I played the Rainbow Six, $240. I had a couple of one single. That was like a 6 claimer. A maiden 20 where I went too deep. Long story short, get into the last race, and I'm alive with 6 pieces. 2 of them are $3.3 million. It's a 5-furlong, $75,000 grass sprint. And it was a $240 ticket, but it was cheap races that I said, you know what, here's a price horse, I'm going to take a stand. Here's a price horse, I'm going to take a stand. You know, when I went light, obviously I didn't get the whole pool, but it did pay $60,000 with the second choice. Blue Bahia, Jason Service.
Yeah, Blue Bahia, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So, pick 5 was $19,000. It was a great day.
Look at you.
Yeah. My wife was in Costa Rica. I picked her up at the airport. I said, I almost retired today, but not quite.
Almost retired.
She's like, what happened now? I'm like, no, I almost hit the big one.
Well, and big ones, we should pause before I ask about the mandatory approach and what you do here, and also the difference for you between this contest and basically the win place concepts versus the live money. We'll get to that, but remind everybody, I called him the big skyscraper, and that's part of his email address. Roger works at the literally the highest level, erecting the framework for some of New York City's most most well-known landmarks on the skyline, and talk about that.
Yeah, we just Manhattan West is a 72-story, 1,000-foot-tall building that we're in the process of finishing right near the...
The old post office, right? Is that,
right,
that project?
It's right across the street from it, right? Yeah. So, and we've got 4 projects on that site, and we have another one that's 10 stories shorter than the one we just finished that we're digging a hole for now. So, yeah, it's great. Great client, and it's entertaining at times. It's very frustrating. It makes you crazy, but it's just like everything else. It's good.
Explain what portion of the construction element do you do?
So I basically manage the site. So I'm the overall site manager. So we don't self-perform any of the work. We buy it out from subcontractors.
Okay.
We manage them. So.
Well, how did you start in this?
Oh, my dad, my brother. My dad did it for 45 years. So I learned underneath him.
Structural engineering or?
Construction management.
Okay, no engineering though.
No,
because my dad's a civil engineer and an estimator. That's his end.
I went to Wentworth Institute in Boston, Massachusetts, construction management. They were the only ones that would take me at the time.
Where'd you grow up?
New Jersey.
In Jersey.
Tenafly. Yeah.
Tenafly. There you go.
Yeah.
So now you know the backstory. I mean, the NHC, what's interesting about the NHC is that virtually every walk of life, and this is just the general diagram of horse players in general, people from any arena, and that's what one of the things, and looking forward, as always, to getting the encyclopedia of the players, Michelle Ravencraft and Keith Shamblin put together a wonderful bio book that gives a, you know, for the most part, gets all of the players, gives you their backgrounds and you know, where they're from and so forth, and their history in contest play, and it's always interesting to thumb through, because we've got people all ages, young to old, and male, female, and husband, wife teams, and you name it. And they come from every kind of background.
That's what makes it great, right? You got people from everywhere who do all different kinds of things, and you bring them all together. It's great.
When did your dad bring you to the track? What was the track?
No.
How'd you get in?
I migrated myself, actually, somehow. With just friends in high school. I mean, I remember.
Really?
I started off in harness, actually.
Going to Meadowlands?
Yeah, betting the Meadowlands, yeah.
Occasional freehold trip now and then?
Yeah, it's crazy. But, yeah, that's how I started. I remember reading in high school I used to have the paper, the harness paper, like in my bag.
Harness Eye?
The Harness Eye. There you go. And then went to Monmouth once and was like, wow, this is great.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Then that was it. I was hooked.
It's all over for you.
It was all over.
And, of course, you know, we also, you know, Roger's gotten into ownership, has got horses with our man Chuck Simon. The two babies.
We're actually running today.
Are you really?
We are.
I missed that.
We are in the seventh today with Noble Maria. We're expecting her to run real well, so. Maiden 50 in the grass.
That's your race. That's your specialty.
She's in the seventh today. We had we sold True Timber's half sister on Monday. Honor Indy was her name. She's at Honor and Serve.
Yeah.
Lickety Lemon, you remember?
Sure.
She didn't turn out to be much of a racehorse. Trained good, didn't run great, but we got $30,000 for her, which was great for a horse that never broke her maiden. So that was good. Yeah, thank you, True Timber.
Nice.
Because the better he got, you know, after a while, like as soon as he ran in the Cigar Mile, we just said, you know what, it's time to put her away. And we were going to sell her anyway. But once he was grade one place, it was like, this is good. So she sold on Monday.
Very nice. So she'll get as a broodmare prospect.
As a broodmare prospect, yeah. So that was really good.
Oh, she didn't go through the ring. You did it privately?
No. She went through the ring.
She did go through the ring.
Fezzik tipped in on Monday.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, and Deputy Czar's doing well. He's had some feet issues and little things here and there, but he's going to run the end of the month. We're still very hopeful. I didn't listen to you. We turned down a rather substantial offer, possible offer anyway, to buy him.
As I learned with Chuck and I, going back to Someone Loves You, the answer is always yes. When that phone rings, the answer should always be yes, is what you say. When someone says, keep 10% for yourself and for your people, and yes, the answer is yes.
So he didn't, he left it up to us, but the reality
is. It's hard, I know.
Yeah, it's hard, and you know what? It wasn't a life-changing amount of money,
right.
So that's really the key.
Yeah.
And Chuck swears he's going to be better as a four-year-old, that he's going to grow into his tall, slender frame. So, you know what? When you pay $14,000 for a horse and you think he can really run, what's a couple hundred grand going to do
for
you?
Exactly.
You're going to go back to the sale and you're going to spend it and you're going to get something that won't even make it to the races possibly. Like, really?
Well, that's my favorite. That's one of my favorite quotes from the late Harry Alleo with Lost in the Fog.
Right.
Lost in the Fog starts to go on his run, and the modest background, pedigree, etc., and the offers start pouring in, seven-figure offers. And somebody asked Harry Alleo, Harry, why aren't you interested in selling? He said, what am I going to do with the money? I'm going to go out and try to find a horse like Lost in the Fog.
I agree with him.
that was he was something. Him and Greg Gilchrist. It was one of my favorite runs. And it's funny. There's a horse. Certainly, there's plenty of sad and tragic things that happen. But boy, that was like. Like Brian's Hope, an equine Brian's Hope, basically. Unbelievable. Back to the mandatory question. What do you do on the mandatories, Roger? Do you just swim along and accept the a lot of times the obvious, or what's your strategy when it comes to the races that everybody has to play?
So my problem is whenever I bet favorites, they never win, right? So it's just like, so I usually don't just swim along, but on the other hand, a lot of times I'll just get swamped in the mandatories too. So like with two entries this year, I really got to get myself to split them and not bet the same horse on both, at least for the first day, because it's really tough when you have a bad first day.
Yeah, you're on the defensive.
Yeah, you're on the defensive, so I got to try. I mean, you don't want a cap horse to get by you, because that could be, that could be bad, right? Because there's 600 and something people, a lot of people are going to have them if in a mandatory you get a cap horse.
How has your approach to the mandatories changed over the 10 runs?
It really hasn't. Like, I always look for the best value, the longest price in there. Which is the way I bet anyway. So
yeah.
I mean, I just have a hard time betting favorites because I just do. They just never seem to win.
Well,
and it just infuriates me if I bet them and I see some 20-1 shot gallop past them. It's like I want to put my head through the wall.
Well, and as we've laughed and as we've pointed out many times, Roger is one of the great rooters at any racetrack. That video of the guy at the OTB on Long Island is making the rounds again. But he's got nothing on you.
I laughed when I saw the replay of the Eclipse Awards. Somebody was watching it, and there I am yelling at the screen.
Absolutely. I saw it myself. I forgot to bring that up with you.
Yeah, it was funny.
Roger's got the program. He's working the program.
Hands flaying.
In the two top finishes, running second the two times, have you compared your approach and how things unfolded and duplicated that, or is each one of these organic and just amorphic, and you have to react to what's going on as things unfold?
Yeah, so the first one was the last year in 13 that they gave you this double bet.
Oh, that's right.
So I don't remember the name of the horse, but I remember it was a maiden grass race at Gulfstream. And I remember Josmin Santana rode the horse. I don't remember his name, but he had one of those. He ran for maiden 50, and he had one of those concealed thoroughgraph numbers that were just as fast as all the maiden special weights. And I saved that double bullet for him, and he was 35-1. He won like a champ. So I love horses stepping up in class. Like, when they're going good, move them up. It's a big, big deal. If you there's a few in Friday, one at the fairgrounds, move them up. When they move up, I'm all over it, like both hands, especially when the connections know what they're doing, right? Like, I love when they move up.
That's an interesting – it's funny you bring this up, because maybe a month ago we had the discussion about a horse facing winners for the first time after a maiden win, especially a horse that may have taken six, seven, eight times to break his maiden. And the general public will look at that, you know, horse facing winner. Oh, it took so long for him to break his maiden. It won't be. But in fact, there's a lot of times where that horse, obviously something went right for him to break the maiden or her. And why are you presuming that they're not necessarily not maybe a different horse, but certainly a better horse than they were in all the times leading up to that maiden win? And a lot of times, especially if they're facing horses who have also been struggling to clear that next condition, and sometimes they win right back.
Yeah, sometimes they do. I usually, first winners, I always take them off. Especially if they're over bet, like, it's one thing over 30 years of doing this, it's like, you can't take a five-claimer that'll run six furlongs in 109 and put him in an allowance race, and he's not going to run the same figure. Like, the strength of the field, to me, is a big deal. Like, it's really, really a big deal on how strong a race is that a horse is coming out of. Like, perfect example is your man Gary Siaka there. I've caught him. I was all over testosterone. All over testosterone. I was like, I have seen him Candid Desire. He did the same thing. They're over their head, and all of a sudden, hey, they're where they belong. And boom. He didn't have any of them Friday, which was depressing, but maybe Saturday. But no, it's, you know what? When they get to where they belong is when they run their best. It is so true. And you could take speed figures, and like, that's what kind of gravitated me to Thoroughgraph, because the buyer figures are just, they run this fast, and it's a big number, and it just doesn't mean anything. It's the quality of the competition's a big deal. I mean, even with Thoroughgraph, I see, well, it's a big number. I'm going to go back and look at the field. All right, well, was the field any good? There's a horse Friday at the fairgrounds who's moving up into an allowance race, and he just won for 15. He won for 30. The field for 30 was really good. And this allowance race has got all these horses that are one for eight, one for this.
Exactly.
One for that.
Exactly.
Give me the one that's got five wins, like all day, every day,
I absolutely agree. And you know, horses, you'll see this. You'll see this a lot of times in conditionals. You know, non-winners of two, non-winners of three. You know, some that have got timestamps. You know, in the last 6 months, etc.
Yeah.
And you would always prefer the hot horse that knows how to win to the ones that have been, you know, banging their head against the wall. I mean, we've had this conversation forever when it comes to building important, you know, multi-race tickets, and you've got maidens, and, you know, having to look at career maidens in some cases, or, you know, horses that are really struggling. I'll give you an example just from this past weekend, this Omaha Beach from Saturday, right, at Santa Anita. Now, here's a horse that, you know, obviously is going to be the favorite. It's going to be a short price favorite. He's 0-4. He's run second. Harvey Wallbanger actually was doing the same thing.
Same thing.
As a 2-year-old. And you know, these are horses that are going to be 4-5, 6-5, and you say to yourself, can I single them? Okay, yeah, sometimes they're going to, the light's going to come on, or they're going to find a field that works. Of course, we had the wet track on Saturday at Santa Anita, and Omaha Beach absolutely airs. But I played with one bad boy who, you know, had a dirtied up trip for Baltus in his debut.
Exactly.
And I thought, you know what? If Omaha Beach is going to be one of these horses that doesn't want to pass somebody, then give me this one bad boy who's going to be 3-1, 4-1, 7-2, something. And it didn't work, but.
No, but you bet against horses like that, like 3-5. Like, what are you doing with that? Right? Like,
yeah.
Like, really?
Exactly. And that was, you know, I used one bad boy for the, I was the host for Express Bet to beat the host last week.
Yep.
And I did it a couple different places. There was going to be feedback at coming off the layoff. And, yeah, she's probably going to win, but she's going to win and pay, you know, $260. So I tried the Colebrook horse that was coming in from Tampa, I thought might be something.
Yeah,
she ran terrible.
I tried the Wilkes horse that ran.
Champagne Problems.
Yeah, Champagne Problems. She ran really well.
Yeah, she was.
She got beat in nose for second. I think. Yeah, she finished third. She ran good.
She ranged up and feedback kept finding more.
Kept finding more.
Yeah. Roger. One of the other parts of this equation, the atmosphere in here, which you of course contribute to in no small part, and. Your man Frank Sorensen on hand. Frank's out jogging. He's out doing his road work right now.
Him and Lauren Weiss, yes.
And of course, Lauren, part of the posse out of Toronto.
Yes.
How'd you just met Lauren on the march?
Yeah, just met him on the march. We used to go to Woodbine. Frank and I went a lot, actually. Can't remember where we met him first. May have been up there.
Probably at Woodbine.
Yeah, we used to go. Their contest used to be great. They would give back. They wouldn't take money out for anything. Like, everything, the trips, this and that. And then they, like everybody else, they started taking out. And then one year I made a nice hit up there, and I went and exchanged the money in New York, and like 40% of it was gone. I was like, hell with this. I ain't going up there.
Well, it works both ways. When I was living in Montreal and working in Canada, and there was, when I first got there, I was being paid, you know, by an American company, and you were getting $1.36 for every dollar. So it was a pretty good gig
That was a good gig.
I love it. Lauren, one of Ray Arsenault's running mates, and in with that group, and Lauren, a big part of making the Pegasus betting challenge happen.
Yeah. Yeah, they were instrumental in it, which I was going to try to do it this year. Once it rained, I'm glad I didn't, because I would have just got – it wouldn't have been good for me.
That's an interesting question as well, contest-wise. It looks right now like even Santa Anita looks clear now for Saturday.
Yep.
Can't speak to Sunday yet, but it sure feels across the country Friday and Saturday that we should not have any weather impact. And over the years, there has been weather that's impacted it.
Yeah, there has been. Yeah, it looks pretty clear for Friday and Saturday. Today, Oakland looks like it's getting a storm this morning, but then it's going to blow through. But for anybody playing today. Like Frank is playing today.
Are you not bothering
with the
last chance, first chance?
3 days is enough.
Yeah, it's exhausting.
Oh, it really is. So yeah, no, the weather looks good. Last year we had slop all over the place.
We had everywhere you looked, it was difficult.
Actually, in 2013, Santa Anita was like a quagmire for 3 days, but it actually worked out good for me. So I'm not a big fan of sloppy racetracks. They're very inconsistent.
Now,
that's really my big problem with it.
Now, there's so many. I won't even say negatives, but just adjustments that end up having to be made, and there's certain things you can't count on just because of the way, particularly pace unfolds, where fields will spread out, you have tendency to, you know, have horses much further back than they might, you know, normally be, and so often, like we saw in fact Saturday, horses get on the lead and forget it's over.
Yeah, absolutely.
Roger, best of luck, of course. And it's a tradition here in Vegas, the first day, Thursday broadcasts of having Roger Satina. And you can follow Roger on Twitter. And I never remember the number because there's numbers.
6193.
61 Skyscraper, 6913.
6193.
6193. What's that stand for?
That is, back in Rockingham Park on a Friday night when I was in college.
June 1st, 93?
No, I hit a big super, 6193.
Were the four numbers?
Well, those were the four numbers. And back, so back then, I think it paid about $7,000-$8,000. And, when you're in college and you're tending bar, that's a big hit, right? And Harry Vega, my man.
Oh, I love Harry Vega.
On a Friday night at the Rock. I used to love Rockingham.
The Rockingham was a wonderful, wonderful place.
That place was great.
Wonderful.
That place was awesome. So that number has stuck with me since then.
That is so great.
Yeah.
Do you find yourself every so often punching up a random 6193?
Oh, not really, but yeah. I always try to keep those numbers involved anyway.
That is so funny. I'm glad I asked because that's a classic.
They used to have great racing Friday night, Saturday. Rockingham was great. Nice turf course. It was a lot of fun.
Well, and
I'm starting to feel my age.
Rockingham for us, for those of us in New York, Saratoga, the Rockingham Shippers was a big deal.
Yeah.
There would be summers where they'd come in from the Rock and they'd be hot. My man Mikey Arrow.
Yeah.
Big shout out to Mike.
Yeah, absolutely.
Arrow was Arrow and Askimopoulos.
Yeah, Charlie Askimopoulos.
Charlie Askimopoulos. Yeah. Two for Bobby DeBona and all the boss. In fact, we were talking lately with the Matisses, not with Duke, but just with Paulie and with Marvin and Tommy and everybody. They were talking a lot, the fairs and Rockingham and New England Racing and Berkshire Downs and Green Mountain and
the good old days.
Absolutely.
When people used to actually go to the track, right?
Well, and that did you when you were obviously college in Boston? Did you take in some Taunton and some Wonderland? And
no, I never got dogs? Into dogs, but Suffolk Downs and Rockingham were.
There you go.
Between classes and tending bar, that's where I was.
And obviously it didn't impact your success going forward.
No, it worked out all right. Worked out all right.
Roger Satina, everybody. And Roger looking to improve on his two second-place finishes in NHCs.
And I'm going to be sitting right in front of you so you could see the show live.
They'll absolutely, and tomorrow and Saturday and Sunday, you'll hear. The magic of the microphones will pick up Roger at least once or twice.
Absolutely.
Because I've referenced you when we've been on air during a rooting interest period.
And let's get a winner for Chuck Simon today. Noble
best
Maria
of luck. Get lucky. Get
go.
Lucky. Noble Maria.
He's due.
Chuckles, our man.
He's got Tropicality in today, too, I think.
All right, so look for a two-win day from our
exactly.
man.
Exactly.
Cannon Shell. Roger Satine, everybody. Pat Cummings is sitting close by, and we'll get Pat in here. More fun and interesting information emanating from the Thoroughbred Idea Foundation. We'll talk to Pat next. Tony Black, Steve Haskin, much, much more. NHC officially starts tomorrow. Today, the last chance, first chance, we're at the Treasure Island. Back after this.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Tickets to the Belmont Stakes Racing Festival are on sale now. New York's premier three-day racing festival returns to historic Belmont Park June 6th through 8th. Buy tickets today and enjoy trackside reserve seats or enhance your experience with one of our premium hospitality packages to make this an unforgettable event. Grandstand admission starts at $15 and three-day festival passes are also available. Buy now at Ticketmaster.com or visit BelmontStakes.com. The Belmont Stakes, where champions are crowned.
Hi, this is retired race caller Tom Durkin. So, after this year's Derby, I stopped by Top Round Roast Beef on Shelbyville Road in St. Matthews. I got two sandwiches, one for back at the hotel and another for the trip back home to New York. The first one was so good, I had the other one right there. Certified Angus beef, roasted 5 hours, each one made to order. You can taste the difference. Top Round Roast Beef, Shelbyville Road, St. Matthews. Tell them Tom Durkin sent you. Oh, by the way, try the frozen custard, too.
Hi, John Parada here, inviting you to join me in the Dublin Racing Club, along with friends like Steve Bick and Tom Durkin. If you have an interest in Ireland and horse racing, it's the best way to be involved with both. So log on now to DublinRacingClub.com and come join us at one of Ireland's 26 racetracks.
The Dublin Racing Club is designed to introduce racing fans to the ownership experience by participating in the sport in Ireland. For more information on the Dublin Racing Club, log on to DublinRacingClub.com.
There's more good news about Pennsylvania's breeding program. Last year, the number of state-bred live foals rose by nearly 30%. Many other states saw a drop of between 10 and 20%. This says that Pennsylvania truly has North America's fastest-growing and most lucrative breeding program. And unlike some other states, our Racehorse Development Fund can only be used to support Pennsylvania breeding and racing. This is Brian Sanfratello. Please visit us at PABred.com.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-938-4643.
Destination unknown.
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
We're back. So we're back in Vegas. We knew the destination, although we did have to shift, and I should address that. We had to shift flights yesterday at the last minute. And when I went to go check in on Tuesday, I see this warning from Southwest saying, we'll give you, it was like a one-time only offer. Act now. Move your flight. Here's your choices. I'm like, well, move my flight for why? And so I start to go look, and here's the weather warning. An ice storm, and this. I hadn't heard a word about the thing. Winter storm Lucien. Not Loren. But so I'm thinking, well, what am I going to do here now? I mean, because I was on a 2:30, I was going to do the show and get to the airport, and I said, ugh, all right. So, and it actually, you know, it was going to be easier if Tina brought me early morning and didn't have to leave the car. So she had to go pick it up the next day because we're going to be gone for 2.5 weeks and so on and so forth. So.
Were you on a direct flight?
No. Went through Baltimore and, you know, left at 7 and got here at whatever, 12:30. And that was great. And then almost didn't get on the air anyway because the ballroom was locked up here. They got an empty ballroom with the tables and chairs, and that's it. And you would think that I've been coming here, that's fifth year. Usually, you know, usually the things are wide open and there's guys, you know, setting up and, you know, for later. Couldn't even find security to open the place.
It took me a while to find the one unlocked door.
Well, that's the other thing. Yeah, it's like let's make a deal and you see which one. So literally, Roger was here to help, but literally got in here at 57,
goodness,
55, 56 maybe. Plugged in, had to go find the jack in the wall here, and. Virtually, when I texted Casey, we're good. You said 30 seconds. So that's about as close. Casey and I have had a couple of other close calls in the 15-second range or so. But this ranks up in the top five of barely getting on the air. But great to start with Roger, as we seem to do now every year, because I've come, I think the first year when I came and set up, and Roger was like the first person in the ballroom, and so I got put him on. Then the next year, same thing. So then after that, it became
tradition.
What, you want me to come down?
Yeah,
for? I'll get you coffee, and we'll get going. So we're underway. And as Pat Cummings joining us, a quick couple of notes that we missed, of course, from yesterday. The sale, Roger mentioning that that he and Chuck sold Honor Indy at the sale. Well, the sale was good. Sale ended up strong, and numbers were up in average and median, and people got to bring home a lot of broodmares. And probably next week when we get a chance with Sid, there certainly were some notable first crop sires, some stallions that first crop will be, you know, next year, and mares that were in foal and so forth that were a little bit notable, I thought. And we'll get to that. You've got at some point, probably, I guess tomorrow with Marty McGee, when we talk to Marty about Tampa Bay. The Tampa Bay card, Sam Davis and the Tampa Bay stake, as well as the Endeavor and the Suncoast. So the three graded stakes, the three grade threes, plus the Suncoast. The Suncoast, the prep to nowhere. It's one of the strangest. It's funny because Tampa has upgraded so nicely. You know, Sam Davis became a grade three. The Tampa Bay Derby became a grade two. And then here's the Suncoast, the fillies, the three-year-old fillies. They get to start, but then there's no Tampa Bay Oaks for them next month. It's very strange. So the Suncoast, but it came up interesting, and they had a terrific card. Rimska cross-entered in both the Suwannee River and the Endeavor, so we'll see what she does. Kind of get the sense that she will maybe stay at Gulfstream, but that Tampa card, Marty is on hand, and Marty, of course, always handles the Kentucky Derby future wager, and the future wager pool 2 came out. There's actually a dozen new names and faces that are added to the list, including some emergent types like Owendale, for instance, and part of the field. You got Vekoma, who didn't make the first, or actually he did make pool 1. I didn't think he made pool 1. But
Walking Thunder, the Dubai-based
yes,
is on there.
Yep.
Has been oddly just dominant for Ahmed Bin Harmish, but the connections are that's the Phoenix Syndicate.
Yes,
it's the Phoenix Lady Syndicate. He's a Kopai Violence, and it's just looked very impressive. And he comes out today in the 2,000 guineas. So
nice.
You know, before you know, it's one of those things to just kind of check up on and see how that goes in Dubai. It's a small field, so. But he's been very dominant in just a few starts over there.
Bourbon War, Global Campaign, Gray Attempt, Harvey Wallbanger, Hidden Scroll, Limonite, Owendale, Tacitus, Tax, Vekoma, Walking Thunder, War of Will, and Win 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 are the new individual names that were added to the pool. So we'll go over that with Marty tomorrow, and opens up for bidding tomorrow and closes on Sunday. Keep that in mind. The Triple Crown nominations came out, 362, about the same as last year. And there you go. A couple of headlines to dive in. Well, there's regular headlines from the Thoroughbred Idea Foundation, and we like talking to Pat Cummings about them and anything else. And the latest white paper offering, Pat, coming out, and there's actually been a couple of news and notes from you, Craig Burnick, and the team. I talked to Paul Matisse yesterday about some things going on as well, and bring everybody up to speed with not just, you know, what we're going to talk about today, but also the reception and the response to these discussion points and how they can be converted from balls in the air to balls through the hoop.
Yeah. It's a great point, Steve. We're and I just kind of had a follow-up yesterday meeting on one of those topics, and that's the topic of breakage. which is the first one that we tackled.
Right.
And it's one thing to put the paper out there, but the next level is to determine and identify how are we going to go forward? How are we going to make this actionable? And the approach that we've decided to take, which I think is a very logical one, is to really just go after the state of New York, which already has, as we've discussed before, the nation's most liberal breakage policies. But if we're going to affect change, if players are going to feel this in their pockets, what's the best way? And also the path of least resistance. How are we going to get something that, relatively speaking, hasn't changed much, if any, over, at least in New York, it hasn't changed in 25 years, but in many other jurisdictions, it hasn't changed in 90 years or so. How do we get something actually accomplished here? And it's, you know, so there are some challenges that we're faced with, and the approach that we're taking is to pursue this and to go after the state of New York. And when I say go after, I mean, you know, just focus our efforts on getting laws changed. This is about getting laws changed in New York, statutes changed. And the way in which the laws in New York are written, and most horse players, I don't think they necessarily realize just how substantial Steve Crist's work on this was back in the mid-90s to get New York to the position where they are now. But the law, as it's written, is very specific in the statute. It straight up says if you make... if the return on your bet is under $10, it's a nickel for every dollar. And if we can just get that nickel changed to a penny, 62% of win payouts in New York, 85% of place payouts, and 96% of show payouts are under $10. The amount of money that would go back to horse players, you know, having $100 to win on a horse, or $2 to win, the extra, you know, it could be 5, 6, 7 cents, doesn't matter, that could go back to you over time, it will add up substantially. And we're actually in the process right now, we should have some things done in the next week or so, of modeling the actual numbers of how this would look to the state, how it would look to NYRA, what they lose in the front door, and what we would anticipate they would get through the back door, through the churn that's going to come from players getting this money back. And there's a lot of assumptions that you have to make in these things. But we're going to take that. We'll take it to New York. We'll take it to the Horsemen. We'll take it to NYRA. And hope to get some support on the legislative front. But you have to kind of... You have to come up with a game plan. You have to have a strategy, how you're going to attack this. And this is something that we started back in September. We're getting to this point now where we're hoping to take it forward and really provide them with a case.
And obviously, if you get one domino to fall, especially if it's a big, tall domino that wide through the middle that will basically not just, you know, knock over the next one, but potentially, you know, just monolith the whole industry. Because as I asked you at the time when it came to this, the potential even for an ADW to take the initiative and go into their pocket as a marketing concept, that had even potential. And certainly if it was to happen in New York, you know, NYRA Bets and et cetera, this is something that much like the withholding change. And you know, it's funny because when I talked to Paul Matisse, he said something last night, so did John Nichols. The effect of the withholding change last year, you know, for those that are saying, well, these are short strokes, they're not short strokes, they're enormous, and they've got a tremendous trickle down effect
without question.
And Paul Matisse, who's as big a player as there is in the game, did not have one single withholding, not withholding or even a signer last year, the whole year. Now, he's a professional gambler, and so he's going to get hit a little bit on the taxes because he, you know, it's a total package for him. Yeah, it's a little bit different. John Nichols, including a pick six that John hit for just under six figures, $2,800 ticket for, I think he hit for $98,000, no Snyder. You can't imagine what this has done. And frankly, Paul made the suggestion, Pat, that if that had not been in place last year, the numbers, the betting numbers, were up just a little bit, and were solid. Even if you want to just say that they were flat.
Yeah.
If Paul says without the withholding, it would have been a bad year.
I believe it. The trickle down. This is an ecosystem, okay, and every action does have an effect in so many different downstream points. The tax withholding is one. Breakage is one. And we're doing this to make the tie back in what is becoming the most competitive gambling landscape in the history of this country, of this continent, that these aren't just kind of simple decisions to placate players who have felt affronted for years. This is about doing things. These are macroeconomic decisions that have huge implications for players, for businesses, for the industry, and that will affect all levels of this industry. This affects horsemen, it affects purses, it affects breeders, it affects lifetime purse earnings for horses, participation rates. It's everything. Small decisions have huge, enormous impacts. There's no question the tax withholding was hugely responsible for the 3% bump last year, which was the most substantive rise in handle, albeit off of a historically low number, but the most substantial rise in handle in the last 15 years or so. And what we should see, not a one-year effect on this, there should be multi-year effects of how this, to take someone like Paul, like you said, and the way the business sense that he approaches his operation, this isn't just going to affect him for 2018. It's going to affect him for every year going forward. And all of these are truly interconnected, and we need to look at our entire industry more as a total kind of economic system as opposed to just small little wins, or they're not just broken windows. There's a huge impact and a huge downstream impact. And by highlighting these sorts of things, we just need to see the action. We need to see other people come to the point and support this and make it happen. And like I said, with breakage, we're kind of continuing that. People don't see it. It doesn't show up on Twitter. But it's an ongoing work.
You mentioned the competitive gambling landscape and the wholesale shift was basically triggered by the work of Dennis Drazen and the New Jersey Horsemen. I haven't had a chance actually to talk about the money that's coming New Jersey's way for both the harness and for Thoroughbred, and some very tough decisions to be made, and some concern that the wrong decision seems to be being pushed on Monmouth, which is to do a super meet with that money, which is, I think, a huge mistake. But anyway, what the hell? They tried it in 2010, and there was no lasting positive impact.
And they need a subsidy in 2019.
It doesn't make any sense to repeat the... They should be competing with the landscape in the Mid-Atlantic, and basically need to put it into the overnight purses, and that will have a much more long-term stabilizing effect. But you mentioned the gambling landscape, and that's the work of the most recent white paper.
Yeah, the landscape in New Jersey. New Jersey is so far ahead of everybody else at this point, and I actually think it is worth talking about just where things stand there. The law of what New Jersey is going to give is basically $10 million a year each to the Thoroughbreds at Monmouth, and then spread across the standardbred landscape. But the law, as it's written, specifically suggests that in order to get the subsidy again, you must provide proof of success, that what you are doing is having an effect, that there's an impact on handle. Now, it doesn't lay out metrics. It doesn't say specifically. And so there is a little bit of wiggle room there. But the thought as to the decisions that need to be made going forward, I think there's an opportunity for Monmouth to become one of the most friendly, player-friendly tracks out there if they start making decisions to say, we need to get handle. We need people to bet on our product. Here's an opportunity, because the only way we're going to get this extra $10 million is to prove to the state that we are doing something effectively with their money. And a lot of jurisdictions haven't had their feet held to the fire legislatively like what New Jersey is. Now, to the greater point, Steve, this is a tsunami of gaming expansion. Okay. And to me, the title of the paper, Horse Racing and quote-unquote Legal Sports Betting. And we have just a tremendous quote from Maury Wolf in the paper, which when I talked to Maury, I said, Maury, that's gold. People don't understand the concept. Legal does not mean simply allowed by law. And what Maury said is, legal means strategic planning, corporate infrastructure, capital investment, unbelievable amounts of advertising, marketing, a real solid, robust foundation of a solid business. That's what legal sports betting is. It's not just what happened in the garage down the street with your friend in the office who kept some numbers and took that. It's not taking that and suddenly making it legal. It's putting real strong business practices behind sports betting, legitimate enterprise. And so racing is going to have to compete in the landscape where numbers that I've heard coming out of New Jersey, more money has been put into advertising of sports betting in New Jersey than the full budgets of some of these betting companies in European countries. So this one state of 4 million people is out spending on the advertising scale some European countries at this point. And this is just one state, one legalized area.
And to pause with that point, one of the discussion points that has surfaced to that issue is what the gaming community, what the sports wagering community will spend against prospective players versus what our industry is prepared to do, which seemingly is next to nothing.
Right. It doesn't, you know, you put those two people next to each other in a room and you only see one person. You know, all of this growth, too, and this is, I think, a major point of the paper, all of this growth, all of this expansion is happening in a fixed odds environment. So racing has had its parimutuel niche for 90 years. And players complain all the time about not knowing the price. I'm sure there will be plenty of players here at the contest that will be frustrated that the horse that they betted at a minute to post that was 8-1 ends up going off at 5-1, and it could be the difference between getting the Sunday or not. Compare that parimutuel experience right now, where for only the Wynn, Exacta, and the double pools will you know what your anticipated return is roughly 30 seconds after the start of the contest, to fixed odds, where I know that at the moment when I make my investment, here is what I'm going to get back if I am successful in this gambit. So you take all of the trappings of a legal sports business, sports betting business, all of the development, all of the focus, all of the attention is on legal fixed odds, and you have racing in its parimutuel game. And we say that antiquates very quickly. Because every new generation that legalizes, that matures into the market, the next group of people that turn 18 and the next group of people that turn 18, they're going to be confronted with this legal product. Parimutuel defies their expectations.
And is also a complicated explanation and a difficult equation.
Yeah.
My wife happens to be a math teacher to grade school level, and I can tell you this upcoming the next couple of levels are going to be hard pressed to be able to figure out what they're looking at.
Now there's no argument that the super exotics, try supers, pick X wagers, that racing still has an advantage there, because the books don't necessarily want to take six race parlays, and the opportunity for huge scores typically aren't going to be there. What our suggestion is that this is such an individual state-by-state approach. The horsemen have to get out in front of this. The horsemen are the ones who care most about the sustainability of the sport for the future. Okay, they are the ones who are looking out. They need to be looking out for the sustainability of the future. The tracks are places where betting is taking place. You know, we saw what happened in Florida where they basically said, go ahead, get rid of the dog races and let's just keep the casino. And if you really kind of dive into that law and the way that that happened, I mean, it's really incredibly frightening. And so I hope that the future from a racing standpoint doesn't go down that path. But, you know, our suggestion is that the horsemen need to start negotiating for a different approach to betting on their races. Racing has a fantastic carve out with the Interstate Horse Racing Act. It does not explicitly prohibit fixed odds. It doesn't mention it, but it doesn't prohibit it. Okay? It mentions paramutual wagering, but it doesn't say only paramutual, not a fixed odds product. And racing essentially has, Steve, the thing that the leagues have said they want it. The leagues have said they wanted integrity fees or whatever. You know, basically,
they just they wanted a slice of the action.
They want a cut.
The integrity fee is such bullshit that it's preposterous.
Right. But racing through the Interstate Horse Racing Act has a carve out that basically says the horsemen have to be compensated for their action, for the access to the product.
Right.
That's a fantastic thing. So there is opportunity here, but we just have to get ahead of the curve, because if we let 2 or 3 or 4 years go by. And you know, the next generation, everyone wants to talk about attracting young players. All of the focus is going to be on attracting 18 to 25-year-olds to get into fixed odds. Our game looks very challenging at that point. You know, and the analogy we used is, you know, we can't be looking at our sport and negotiating like we're talking to Blockbuster Video in the mid-90s about how much you're going to pay for, you know, a VHS tape or a DVD of our video. You need to be talking about streaming rights. You need to be focused on the kind of the next thing. And so what we think is the best approach is that the horsemen, the horsemen's groups, and New Jersey has started to do this, need to focus on how to offer fixed odds to their customers. And it's not going to be a perfect world. You know, there are some people that have responded to us, you know, various social media things. Oh, I'll take the bookmakers. You know, we'll clean them out, you know, or it'll be too expensive, or, you know, a lot of excuses that are being offered as to why this isn't necessarily going to work. Racing doesn't have a choice. They have to make this work. They have to engage. This isn't about getting a slice of the action. This is about competing in the heart of it. And, you know, it's funny, since we released the paper, I've actually had a variety of what I'll just call Vegas-related entities, sports betting-related entities, reaching out to say, hey, can you connect this with some of these tracks? Can you, these horsemen's groups you talk about, can you make a connection? We'd love to help, and we'd love to be involved. And even one of the people that's quoted in the paper, Bobby Scott from Swish Analytics, who, you know, basically said the concept that you think that this is going to be a bookmaker-driven sport is ridiculous. This is going to be customer-driven. Customers are going to be able to say, I want Steph Curry, 42 points, under 10.5 assists. I want the Warriors over the first half line, under the total. They're going to pick what they want. The customers will pick. And AI is going to be able to price that appropriately. Not today, in a couple of years. They're going to be able to price that appropriately where the customer is going to be happy with the price they get and the book is going to be happy with the price they give. And it's going to take out a lot of the human interference that is involved in this and the concerns over pricing. Racing needs to compete, Steve. And we have this opportunity. We think it's a 2, 3, maybe a 4-year window in states that are a little behind the curve. But all these kind of little fights, especially what we hear from horse players, and they're very valid. You know, takeout, takeout, takeout. Yeah, it is about takeout, but it's about competing. And this landscape that we've been fighting in for 90 years, and a little more legitimately for the last 10 or 12 years about the price of our product, It's going to change substantially given the competitive landscape. And if we aren't a part of it, if we aren't engaging in that, then there is a reason to be concerned about the future. So as much as it is a threat, it's a great opportunity. There's a lot that can be done here. We and our board is very passionate about sharing that sentiment with the industry. The horsemen's groups are going to be empowered at this point to kind of step up. Look, Monmouth Park on Haskell Day last year, they offered 3 fixed odds bets. They handled $21,000 on those fixed odds bets. That $21,000 was handled on track only in that small William Hill Sportsbook area of the track. They outhandled, I think, the first 2 early doubles and the first pick 3 of the day. Now, where were those doubles and pick 3s distributed to versus where those fixed odds bets were distributed? Okay, a very small corner of Monmouth Park versus everyone anywhere had access to those doubles and those pick 3 pools. And these 3 little fixed odds wagers, the first, hardly any marketing. They were approved 48 hours in advance.
Right.
Handled as much as these very widely distributed double and pick 3 pools. It was a first kind of, you know, a toe in a very large pool. And I thought that response that the players gave it on those first days were pretty strong.
We've discussed this topic for years and years and years. Stan Bergstein was still alive, and the paper that was developed for him at his direction in the 90s, which was research done with TAB in Australia, who was pioneering on a paramutual-fueled fixed odds system, which now in Australia and New Zealand is getting close. I know that TAB New Zealand has the option on their ADW platform. People can pick which pool to participate in, and the guys from New Zealand who I saw here last year, I wonder if they'll be back this year, they said that within another 18 months that the fixed odds would eclipse the parimutuel side. And had a conversation last night and yesterday with Paul Matisse. And Paul, I know Paul has floated ideas with you and has some fascinating suggestions. And that includes even creating a market on the movement.
Yeah.
People not even necessarily betting the horse, but betting where the market is going to go.
Options, basically.
Yes, it puts in calls, basically, on whether a horse is going to raise in odds or drop in odds, and there's a whole new revenue pool.
Yeah. I mean, we put out a crazy idea, which is racetracks can put photo finish cameras at the half-mile pole and basically create a new race and a new market. Who's leading at the half-mile pole? The NBA doesn't give teams a win for leading at the half.
But
they sure as heck take bets on who's leading at the half. Okay? You know? So, and it sounds, you know, to the racing traditionalist, it sounds crazy. It sounds so far-fetched. But the market is there. The customers are there for it. They want to engage in that product. Why aren't we giving it to them? There's no reason that we shouldn't be evolving to that point. I do want to kind of offer a rebuttal to something that was floated in August. And I must say that the Jockey Club at the round table in August came out and basically Stuart Janney, the chairman, said very clearly, why not us for fixed odds? And we agree with that. And we put that in the paper. But the McKinsey study and the consultants that came out did offer one rebuttal that said, we don't think this is going to cannibalize customers all that much, sports betting, legalized sports betting, based on their own surveys. And what they saw was sports betting in international markets where racing was also doing well.
Mm-hmm.
They used Australia, Ireland, France, and Hong Kong as examples.
Right.
And a rebuttal to that. They said, racing's great in Hong Kong, football betting, soccer betting, very strong. In the last 5 years, racing in Hong Kong's up 18%. Soccer betting's up 66%. In Australia, in the last fiscal year reported, racing was up 6%. It's great. All sports betting was up 15%. So what we're talking about is exponential growth in alternate markets that are not racing.
Floating a question, how much of that growth do you believe is in response to the next generation statistical data explosion?
Yeah, without question. Our next paper is going to be about data. And we've already done some of the research and had some of the discussions. And again, I go back to Maury, but Maury's great. I mean, you can't not. Maury.
There's only one wolf.
Maury just, he has a way of putting things in perspective that you hear it and you say, God, that's so obvious. But I never thought of it that way. And Maury, who has bet sports for many years, not just racing.
Baseball, baby.
Yeah. Maury says, Pat, I can spend $200 a year and consume all of the possible information I would need to make an informed decision on baseball. $200 a year. I get access to the databases, many of which are free, but the newsletters I want to follow, kind of the shrewd opinions, people who frame things in different lights for me. Spend $200 a year.
Well, for starters, Baseball HQ is $89 a year, and you might not need anything more than that.
Yeah, exactly. No one talks about the cost of data in other sports because there's nothing to talk about.
there hasn't been. Put a qualifier on that, and I don't want to pretend. Don't pretend that subscriptions to these explosive data services, which are going to come along with the sports betting, don't think for a minute that they're not going to be priced accordingly.
The definition of premium in that market, though, based on the way in which the market exists now, is still going to be relatively inexpensive compared to the cost of data in racing.
True. That's fair.
So, it's this is such a rapidly evolving market, and I've really been following it for the last 2 or 3 months incredibly closely. I was out here at the Consumer Electronics Show a couple weeks ago, which was just fascinating. A couple quick takeaways. David Levy, who is the chairman of Turner, said someone who has a bet on a sporting event is scientifically proven to watch that event 80 to 90% more than someone who doesn't have a bet.
I need you to explain this to Tina, who doesn't understand why I want to watch the race that I bet on as opposed to being able to. You can watch the replay later. Thanks, honey.
Yeah.
Thanks. I know I can watch the replay later.
The difference in sports versus racing is that the sports leagues and the franchises are making their money off of distribution deals through television and through streaming. That's where they're making their money. Their product is becoming more valuable because people have a greater reason to watch and to watch longer. Racing is making its money through the revenue streams directly associated with gambling. Okay, so gambling is indirectly making these sports leagues more money. Mark Cuban comes out and says, our value's doubled today. It's not doubled because of the gambling itself. It's doubled because all of our properties, which we've distributed and where we make our money, all of those have become more valuable as a result.
Right.
We need it. We need to hit these people at the point of sale. Racing's direct tie into this is hitting them at the point of sale. That's where racing's making its money from, not these excessive distribution deals. So we need. That's why we're saying compete in this marketplace. Don't just try and get a slice. That ship sailed 20 years ago with the racinos. It's not about just the concept of a slot revenue trust, et cetera, et cetera. That's gone. Don't think that sports betting is going to be like that. It's time to compete. We have an opportunity, and now it's time to act.
And this gets, and I know that as part of the sports wagering paper, you also had mentioned that that takeout will be addressed in a separate document. The takeout question becomes really, really, as always, difficult because it. I know that everybody wants to boil this down to some magical bullet that is going to slash every takeout, no matter what, down to 6.5%. Explain, Pat, in fairly simple and brief terms, why this is so cumbersome and why there's no easy immediate answer when we don't know what optimal takeout actually is, what it looks like, and what is going to be practical. I mean, obviously there's some places that are just preposterous, like Pennsylvania, yeah. And where there's no, especially Pennsylvania, where there's no reason to have these ridiculous takeout rates. Particularly on multi-horse and multi-race wagers, they've squandered a huge opportunity to draw an interest in their betting product by having it priced preposterously.
Yep.
But in practical terms, what people seem to have forgotten that Barry Schwartz, in his time at the head of NYRA, was whittling down takeout on the whips, and got it down to 14.5%. And lo and behold, the Racing and Wagering Board and the state came and completely ruined that and drowned it and made things come back up high again. That's lost in translation. There have been attempts. Then it's certainly too simplistic to say, oh, the test at Laurel years ago and the test at Canterbury didn't work. No, that's not true.
Yeah.
Because as you talk, it's an ecosystem and there's no
a lot of interconnected parts.
Exactly. Yeah. And people just scream, the takeout's got to be lowered. Okay, yeah, but it's not. There's not some automatic knife wielding surgeon that's going to come in and magically drop everything. Explain how it can be achieved if there's going to be any movement.
There's a lot to unpack there, Steve. So, first off, the average cost of a horse racing bet is roughly 20%. The average cost of a sports bet in a highly efficient market is about 5%. Now, we're seeing a lot of inefficient marketplaces in these early. We were sitting in the sports book yesterday across the street here, and looking at the prices that were being offered in Vegas, and Philly Joe was looking at the prices that were being offered at Parks. I assure you, it's a highly inefficient marketplace right now. They were infinitely more expensive. That will change over time. Okay. At the end of the day, racing is an expensive gambling proposition because the sport is funded by betting solely. Okay, the show happens because of betting, and it's unlike any other gambling entity out there. So racing's always going to be more expensive. And so the takeout extremists who would suggest that, like you said, just wholesale cuts, 7%, off you go. That's not feasible, okay? The sport simply can't fund itself.
And pause for a minute. Explain, you say the average bet, the average number is 20%. Explain where that 20% goes so people understand where the elasticity is and where the ability to trim, whose belt is going to have to be tightened to make this work.
I'll pause you on that because we're coming out with a paper. We came out with a Takeout 101 paper 2 weeks ago up at racingthinktank.com. We're going to have a 201 paper and a 301 paper as part of a series that we're doing. And it's going to explain that a little bit in greater detail. And like you said, it's a complex topic. It's not straightforward. And to whittle it down into 500 words where someone says, oh, okay, is not easy. It's not. And then we need to talk about rebates and understand how the pricing of that works and for certain players. And it's not straightforward. But there's a lot of people that are affected by pricing of racing, not just gamblers, okay? It's prize money. It's the horsemen. It's what the state tax rates are. And we even see this in breakage. The breakage tax rates in New York, Steve, there's like five different breakage tax rates on just how breakage in the state of New York is taxed. It's not just like all this money goes to the horsemen or all this money goes to the tracks. There are some extremely complex calculations But in the abstract, the win, place, and show pricing falls in that, you know, 15 to 17, 18% range. Some are higher than others. And your exotic takeouts fall in that 20 to 25% range. Let's put Pennsylvania aside for a second. And so you end up with that blended take of roughly 20%, of which signal fees, taxes, you know, 80. There's a huge portion that's going back to the players. That separate pie is then divided in some cases 5, 6, 7, 8 times to different entities based upon individual state requirements. So lots of people have their hands in the pot when it comes to negotiating. You can't. It's not just you go to one person and say, cut the takeout.
Exactly.
And that's never going to be the case. However, what we see, there's a light at the end of the tunnel here. This incredibly competitive marketplace that is blossoming around this country should provide the incentive to become a little more optimal than we have. That there is so much focus and so much attention being paid to kind of sports betting, its costs, the market will get more efficient over time, that racing isn't kind of the only non-slot gambling operation that exists in these jurisdictions anymore. That the parimutuel model is, like I said, it antiquates very quickly in light of a fixed odds marketplace. That's true. But there will be opportunity for the discussion about pricing to come into the equation more when states have revenue sources from other types of gambling that are naturally priced cheaper than racing. And so racing will have a way to kind of say, look, you see all this other development. I got to compete in this market now. When I didn't have to compete, you know, prices don't have to change. A very open, deregulated environment, taking it from off the streets and putting it into the shops, that actually provides racing incentive now to compete because they have to. And if they don't, again, the future doesn't look all that bright.
Well, we will certainly the elements and then the next steps, I mean, is the key, you know, the key portion. I mean, I as you said, we'll wait till, you know, you've got the opportunity to, you know, to specify and yep. to suggest, you know, who could be convinced. And you know, on that topic, I would say that the example of the withholding success should serve as a, not necessarily a template, but certainly a learning curve,
yeah.
Which was for the extended period that Alpine Group and NTRA, Peggy Hendershot, were trying to get the rules changed through legislative means, and the difficulty that was involved in explaining to Congress critters, as Charlie Pierce calls them, the difficulty of explaining to them the benefits of dropping the threshold, explaining to them that if we put more money in the pockets of the players, it would create, in the long term, more churn, hence more revenue and more tax, would more than offset the loss in revenue off the top. That proved to be just too cumbersome. And it wasn't until Greg Means and the Alpine Group thought about taking a different tact and going directly to Treasury and IRS and getting them to change the playbook. That's what worked. And so as part of this takeout discussion and initiative to display to the industry the urgency and the particulates that would make up the decision-making process, the awareness of and the necessity of having a different tact and going about it in a different manner than has been attempted previously has got to be part of the game plan.
And I think what you're saying is it's the attack point here is it's not about us. Look at this market. It's all about the all of this other development. Now take a look at us. Look at us relative to that.
Yeah.
You know, and suddenly that picture becomes a lot clearer.
Well, especially when you think about the state governments. Because you know one of the biggest difficulties has been making state government that has become we talk about the advantages that racing was afforded for years as the only game in town until the lotteries states. You know, states got fat and greedy on the revenues from racing, and what has to be what needs to be reminded, I think, to those decision makers in asking them to tighten the belt and lower their skim, is the benefits again to just what was being discussed in New Jersey, which is trying to revive their breeding industry, and the obvious financial trickle down benefits of and also a green industry that can be gleaned, and you've got to go to them and say, look, you've been sucking off this teat for decades.
Yep.
And we need some help now to sort of reinvent our pricing structure.
Yep.
And you've got to participate in it.
The conversation is framed by all of this non-racing activity, which hadn't happened. And it totally changes the perspective on the racing activity. And that, blessing in disguise. You know, I think it might take... There are plenty of reasons to be optimistic. For all the time that we've talked about how many states have allowed parimutuel wagering, that, kind of where gaming laws are a little more liberal, a lot of the conversation has been focused on who's going to allow sports betting. And the number has been around 30 states in the next 3 years is kind of the general consensus.
Which is on a par with what is established already in parimutuel. We got 37 jurisdictions.
And I was speaking...
And Georgia on the horizon.
Georgia, it could. but what could open this up, I actually think, to other states that haven't been participating in this... I think of Texas in particular.
Mm.
When you have sports broadcasts, nationwide sports broadcasts that are so focused now or will be on gambling, and you're in Texas and you're in Dallas and you say, why can't I get a bet on the Cowboys today? Why can't I get a bet on the Texans? Why can't I participate in this market but Louisiana can and Arkansas can? We're not talking about horses running around in circles. We're talking about my football team. We're talking about America's team. We're talking about the boys. We're talking about the Texans. We're talking about UT and Houston and Texas A&M. God, have you ever been to College Station? It's insane. These sports betting reaches far more people. It reaches sports fans. There's a heck of a lot more sports fans than there are racing fans. And you know what? There's a heck of a lot more legislators across America who are sports fans than they are racing fans. And when they see how this is developing around them in jurisdictions that have permissive sports betting marketplaces and those that don't, I'm not an expert in it particularly, but I see dominoes falling that previously otherwise were standing up like Stonehenge, that people thought would never fall. I think the opportunity is for them to fall because it's such a common American experience. Sport, weekend, Sunday afternoons in the fall, March Madness, And now all this extra gambling discussion that is unavoidable. Why can't my jurisdiction be a part of that? There are corollary benefits to racing as a result of that. And if it means, you know, maybe we didn't necessarily do enough on our own to get that, and we weren't able to impact enough people. But by gosh, football, baseball, basketball, hockey certainly do affect far more people. And if we can kind of ride the coattails there and, like I said, compete in this market, I think it's going to be more states than people expect than where they're currently talking about now.
Well, we're going to be, you mentioned the data, we'll be together in March at HBPA, and we have what I think should be an interesting discussion. We unfortunately lost Robin Howlett, who I was looking forward to having, had pushed to get Robin invited. He cannot make it, and in fact, probably will come up, because Robin is so disheartened by the experience that he had creating the handicapper, and you know, this all gets into a lot of these same topics, and his intellectual curiosity, which drew him in, and really something that should be promoted, that the industry should champion, instead has done everything they can to quash. Robin kind of basically demurred, and I was really kind of saddened by it, because I was looking forward to him offering his experience toward the data issue. But we'll have a fruitful discussion. And is that document going to come out in time for the discussion?
It's going to be in and around that time, so I'm hoping so. We've got a little bit of time. That's March, mid-March, the Ides, I believe.
There you go. I'll mention, too, that speaking of data, I'll remind everybody. I brought it up last week, and I can't wait till Barry can join us. And I invited Barry when Robin couldn't make it to the session. I invited Barry Meadow, whose new book comes out in just a few weeks, The Skeptical Handicapper, Using Data and Brains to Win at the Racetrack. And I got an advance copy right before I left. Came Tuesday. And typically wonderful approach by Barry Meadow, who 30 years ago wrote a pamphlet. He's basically the Thomas Paine of handicapping, because common sense is still read and appreciated today, as is Money Secrets at the Racetrack that he wrote 30 years ago. And now his new book, entirely new, fresh approach, and the data topic, a big part of his discussion point, The Skeptical Handicapper, Using Data and Brains to Win at the Racetrack. Look forward to Barry visiting, and Barry is going to contribute to our series that we're calling Game Builder with Nick Tamaro, of course, and we'll be with Nick tomorrow.
What you've done there, and I've listened to the segment, Steve, is fantastic. And I think one thing that...
Not according to everybody!
Well, I know, and that's what I wanted to address. The work that you do on this program, Steve, is exceptional. And I don't think it's been recognized enough by the industry as a whole, even though almost everybody participates. And you kind of have this open door that everyone kind of becomes a part of. It's so fantastic to have this outlet 15 hours a week. This week it'll be more for you, certainly. But it's the heart of the industry. It really is. Everybody comes through here. Everybody's interconnected here. And there's nothing like listening to trainers come on. I mean, many of them have said it to you. I love getting a call from Steve Bick on a Sunday asking me to come on Monday because something's gone right. and to get those perspectives is fantastic. To have the industry dialogue is great. And to have something like that Game Builder session. Look, we're not all professional bettors, Steve. We're not all quants. We're not all sharpies. There are some people that are just trying to learn their way through, and to have a session like that, and it's great that the HBPA has gotten behind it. To have that's helpful, and it doesn't mean you're going to bet like that for the rest of your life. Okay, and some people could poo poo and say when you spent $83 and you turned it into $120. guess what? You didn't lose $83.
Yeah.
You know? So, it's okay. And churn is all right. And it's the same thing when people talk about the rainbow jackpots and how awful it is that it only paid $300. You know what? I put in a $200 ticket at Santa Anita last week and I hit for $296. And you know what? I'm going to have that money to play back the next day and the day after that.
Yeah. Could have paid $600. It could have paid $6,000. Andy Serling's got a terrific line more about just about racing and about handicapping off of results. And Andy says, that you've heard him say this: don't be overly results oriented. That's a snapshot. Yeah. You're looking for a panorama here.
Sure.
You want the full picture, yeah. and a full appreciation. The individual moment and the individual decision is only a speck, in this giant spectrum. So I appreciate that very much. And the learning curve, there's only a certain amount of there's only a certain element that we can talk to.
Sure.
And so the idea is to help as many, as many people on their learning curve as possible. And it's just like every segment during the week. There's people who say, I love when you, in fact, I yesterday, Chris Dewey from Capital District, I met. He's here for his third NHC, he and his wife, or girlfriend, and he said to me, I love the pedigree conversations and the sales when you have consigners on and the breeders on, John Secura and et cetera. And that sort of surprised me, because usually the players only enjoy the handicapping discussions and so forth. Then there's people who love all the handicapping conversation. We're trying to get as many people that enjoy the game for whatever part of the game their interest is. And if they learn another area, that's a side benefit.
Oh, it's like the people that would reach out to me when we had our Hong Kong discussions. People who heard me and talking about Hong Kong and suddenly started playing Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
And I still stay in touch with a couple of them who are very close to following it. And, yeah. And the Dubai discussions over the years.
That's right.
It's
way back.
Great.
That's right.
It's you do a great job. And
thank
it's
you.
It's really, even though, maybe the I think about the Eclipse Award, Stephen. You
that's,
are the that's, Eclipse
that's
Award.
Not, that's
you,
not, yeah,
you, I know, I know. But you are you do such a superb job, and it's such a benefit to the industry, and we need it. Democracy dies in darkness.
Well put. The Washington Post's wonderful
so,
new.
Keep it up, and this is kind of an annual gathering. It's the first time I've actually been here for NHC.
Really,
it is.
I'm surprised at that.
Yeah, but. Just timing-wise, and having not been in the country the last couple of years, but
that's true too. Good point.
But it's good to be here and supporting some of my friends that are playing this weekend and just enjoying the time and all the best and we'll catch up.
Absolute. We'll keep discussing and we'll keep bringing these issues forward. And we appreciate the work that is going into the Thoroughbred Idea Foundation. Some people feel like it's yet another another alphabet or another.
We're trying to specifically not be that.
Well,
but I know.
It's
easy
funny.
To feel that way.
I read an article on the flight out. It's upstairs in my room. I printed it out months ago, and I don't even know how I came across it. But I printed out an article by Whitney Tower from 1957 in SI Vault, 65 Men and the Horse. And it was about the jockey club, obviously. And it prints out the 13 pages. And it's actually Whitney Tower who fit right in with particularly that era's jockey club. It talked about the founding of the Jockey Club and what its goals were and what the initiatives were, so forth. And it it's very interesting because it was well within Tommy Massis making the scene. It was written in 1957, and the roundtable had only really begun like within I think 10 or 11 years, and the outgrowth of even the roundtable and its initiative, which you know could have been looked at the time as you know as yet another even then could have been looked at as a superfluous or redundant or unproductive but in fact so many things have come out of it. You can't, you know, and this is, the industry is like the Queen Mary that, you know, takes 16 miles to make a turn, yeah. The cruise ship. That's one of those realities. And so it progress marches on. The speed at which it marches, it may not be may
the
not
only
be
thing that happens
with alacrity.
With speed in this industry is the running of the races. So,
well, if only we could time them properly. But I'm bump.
Different segments.
I knew you'd love that. Pat Cummings, everybody.
Thanks,
Pat Cummings, TIF, and we appreciate it. We'll take a timeout, and we got to get. Now we're in trouble. We got Tony Black to talk to Steve Haskin. Dickie Powell, speaking of Hong Kong, and Rich Yang is going to be here. So actually, I'll wait on Rich Yang because Rich lives right here in Vegas. So we're going to have Rich live over the next 3 days, as well as Pete Fornatel, who'll be doing the co-hosting, and so many more. Hammer is coming for the first time. Another guy that has always wanted to come to the NHC, and Hammer having more fun in. A new, you know, in a new environment, things he never had a chance to do. We went to a golf outing up in San Francisco this past weekend that he had always wanted to and never could. And so he's going to be here. And I mentioned Rich Yang. Seth Merrow,
yeah,
Capital OTB, is going to be on the scene. So we'll get Seth to sit in as well. He'll be wide-eyed.
And with his roving recorder, no less.
Yes, exactly. Exactly right. Who else? I got a huge list, actually, that's accruing. Dave Goodfriend, Pete Fornatel, is officially lined up a visit with Dave as well, who's going to be playing for over $6 million with the bonuses tied in. So it's all happening, and the players are getting ready for the last chance, first chance, player's choice today, and they're registering as we speak. There's Clocker John Nichols and Marvin, the great bet runner Marv.
Ready what a game.
Unbelievable. We got more characters per square foot than you can shake a stick at. Back after this to Treasure Island here in Las Vegas.
Latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.